CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of the CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers. Lee, if you would like to introduce our sponsors.
Absolutely. Today's show is sponsored by Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney services as outstanding and excellent. Also, SAP Business by Design, a fully integrated business management software solution designed for small to mid-sized companies that want the benefits of large-scale business applications without the need for a large IT infrastructure. And Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
This week's CFO Radio News. In 2010, the Kiplinger letter stated, conditions for merger and acquisitions are improving, signaling more corporate deals in 2010 and 2011. After a tepid 2 years, the dollar amount of transactions will likely climb by more than a third this year. Deal values will hit more than $950 billion in 2010 and continue to grow an additional 20% in 2011. Much of 2009 was a nuclear winter for the M&A industry, says Dennis White, senior counsel at McDermott, Will and Emery LLP, and chairman of the Global Board of Directors of the Association for Corporate Growth, ACG. White blames last year's conditions on the general economic downturn, lack of credit, and a vast chasm between the buyers and sellers on valuations. I think all three are now improving somewhat, he says. Executives are keeping their eyes open for attractive businesses to buy, and they'll actually find the money they need to finance these deals. As lenders remain cautious, companies will rely less on outside financiers, such as private equity groups. Instead, buyers will put in more cash up front as they finally start to release their hold on funds, which they've been hoarding for the past 2 years. With the economic outlook improving, companies are more willing to spend their own money, he says. Now companies feel more comfortable taking on risks, says Dan Tiemann, who heads up KPMG's Transactions and Restructuring Group. You should expect buyers to pick and choose carefully, focusing on expanding existing business lines or filling in gaps in their offerings. The downturn has separated the winners from the losers, says Tiemann. This is a great time for winners to be picking up weakened competitors and gaining market share. They will also look at suppliers and other firms they do business with to increase revenue without building a division from the ground up, and they won't be taking chances on any hot new startups or exciting technologies. Well, we await this year's research to see the outlook for 2011 and 2012. Well, on CFO Radio today, we are joined by our guest, Gareth Young. Gareth joins us to discuss the role of the CFO. Welcome to the show, Gareth.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here, Lorraine.
Well, Gareth, you're principal with Abraxas Business Services, where you're responsible for providing integrated services to first-time sellers and buyers of businesses with revenues in the range $5 million to $30 million. In the industries for technology, manufacturing, distribution, healthcare, and also service industries. You previously led FinanceSite LLC, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, which is a professional services firm you founded to provide financial and operation services to startups and small businesses. And prior to that, you were with Bell South Corporation for 15 years, executing business expansion strategies through merger and acquisition, partnerships, as well as other transactions. You began your career at Deloitte and are a chartered accountant in the UK and a CPA in the US. You have an MA in mathematics from Jesus College, Oxford in the UK. And interestingly enough, your first novel was published in 2009.
It was fun, yes.
Well, Gareth, in your current role, you oversee business transactions for Abraxas Services. You support the role of the CFO in merger and acquisitions transactions. Tell us a little bit, going back to the beginning, leading to your role today. What was your first job and what led you to move into finance?
My first job actually was when I left college and went to work for Deloitte. And back in those days in the UK, the CPA firms, the chartered accountancy firms, offered what seemed to me to be a general business training. So it wasn't at that time about getting into finance at all. It was going and seeing lots and lots of different businesses while I was an auditor. And it accomplished that. So I did that for about 4 years over in the UK.
And were you on the finance side?
I was on the audit side.
Audit side.
And then I spent a little bit of time in the London office as one of the trainers we had up. That was also a lot of fun, just lots of residential training with people who were like 2 years younger than me. And you can imagine what kind of a riot that was. The firm put me on their international management development program. I came across to the States for what was supposed to be an 18-month exchange, but then I ended up getting married and staying here and moved on into the corporate world. And what happened was when public accounting started closing in on me a little bit and it ceased to be going out and looking at different businesses and understanding different businesses and using the financial side to get involved in and understand the business, started drifting more towards process and putting bows around audit files for partners when you're a manager, and that ceased to be anywhere near as much fun. So I was looking for a way to get finance back into a general business context, and that's what took me to Bell South.
So let's talk a little bit about Bell South. Large corporation, heavily partnership-driven, very much in acquisition mode in the time that they were named Bell South. Obviously, today, one of their acquisitions was the joint merger with SBC, and now they've been acquired by AT&T. So the acquisitions still continue. Tell us a little bit about your role in the M&A function.
The group was technically called the Corporate Development Group, and we were technically charged with executing on M&A transactions. But as a practical matter, we were a very kind of an elite task force used inside the company for reviewing and implementing strategic business direction. So, yes.
Almost like an internal consulting function.
It included an internal consulting component, but it was more on the execution side than the consulting side. So, for example, the two biggest deals I worked on while I was there were actually for the same officer of the company. Bill Redison was his name. The first was to get us into the long-distance business, because at the time we were limited to be local only, and our large business customers needed more. So I spent a couple of very, very long months in a hotel in New York negotiating a deal with Quest, which was buying 10% of a public company. But as you can imagine, buying 10% of a public company is actually relatively straightforward. It doesn't take 2 months. What took 2 months was a very complex set of operating agreements. So I didn't just have a bunch of lawyers up there. I had a bunch of ops people up there to make that work. The same guy, we were very successful in the video business, home video. We had what is now mostly the spectrum used by Clear for the wireless internet access. We had a lot of that kind of spectrum that we were using for TV services. People in our territory loved our TV services, but the economics of that particular approach didn't work. So we were exploring lots of different approaches, and I ended up working out a deal with GE where we leased two satellites. So we're going to get into the direct-to-home TV business. Again, that's not technically M&A, but it's using, you can imagine there were very, very complicated financial and operational issues around making that happen.
So were these partnership, joint ventures, strategic alliances?
More
along the lines of joint business ventures?
The structure was designed to accomplish the particular goals of the business at that time. So the satellite, we leased two satellites. With the deal with Quest, we purchased 10% of Quest in order to get kind of a toehold into the company, kind of close them out for others, but also to align ourselves sufficiently that they felt comfortable opening up their OSS to us in the manner we needed to deliver the services that we wanted to our customers. In Latin America, the businesses that we bought down there, we typically bought a controlling interest, 50 to 75%, something of that nature. And typically we kept on a local partner, both for political reasons and also for the marketing savvy that they bring to bear. And, of course, in that construct, the partner wanted very clear exit, wanted registration rights and all the rest, and we had no interest in giving them that. So they were very complicated partnership negotiations for that minority position.
So in that regard, you would have had a group of attorneys, I would imagine,
absolutely,
pretty closely at your fingertips.
Absolutely. There was the field marshal of the lawyers was always the deal lawyer. But yes, we'd have typically an in-country law firm, and then all the regulatory and EPA and all the rest of it, yeah.
So that was a very exciting time in your life. A lot of M&A. You'd left the big firm. Now you're in industry, as we call it. Do you have some advice perhaps for somebody that might be listening to the radio show today and thinking about going into the world of finance or acquisitions as you had done? You started with one of the larger audit firms, and that is, as you had mentioned, a very good business training and education. Would you guide that to the person that is looking to do that today?
I cannot really talk to what happens in a Big Four firm today because I've not been in one for a long time. But generically, what I'd suggest is firstly, keep an open mind. Be willing to do different things, look at doing different things. Secondly, try and work with the very best. So to the extent that you're going to go into public accounting, pick the best public accounting firm and go work there. If you're going to go into industry, pick the best companies. So work with the best people. It doesn't matter what you do in life, but if you do stuff with people who are better than you, you'll get better at it.
Good advice, sage advice, in fact, I would say. So you work with great people. That is
Absolutely. An
assumption based on that being one of your foundations.
Well, they're better than me, aren't better than I am, anyway. I mean, that's what I try and do. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the transactions themselves. That is your world. Many owners of startups see the nirvana of the Googles and the Twitters and all these, and they have the ideas that their idea is going to sell for multi-billions. Is that really what happens?
Nope.
Okay, let's talk about that.
I'll give you a little analogy, first of all. I don't know if you remember. Do you remember OK Go? Yes, okay. OK
yes,
Go,
I do.
For your listeners, if you go on YouTube and you just look up OK Go or the treadmill dance, I think it is. This was a rock band in the UK nobody had ever heard of before, and nobody would have heard of today, except for the fact they made this really, really cool video and stuck it out on YouTube. Now, there are hundreds, probably tens of thousands of really cool videos on YouTube. For some reason, this one sparked the public imagination. 5 or 10 million people went out and looked at it, and they ended up on MTV and got an award. So now they're a big band, right? The Googles and the Facebooks and the other unknown companies, the other companies that today are unknown, it's the same. It's, you know. So I don't know.
Is it that one marketing spark that makes it happen?
But it's unpredictable. It's just completely unpredictable. So, yes, one in a million will rocket to stardom, but most of them will continue to languish. So there's probably thousands of almost OK goes out there. The way we look at the M&A world is a much more manageable and predictable construct where people pay you for the business performance you have generated in the past. They pay you for the business you have today. I mean, crudely, there are two things that go into the value of a business when you buy it. There is the cash flow of the business, and that's some kind of weighted average of historic cash flows, and there's a multiple you apply to the cash flows. The cash flows we could talk about, and the multiple is based on how you present the business, how well run it is, and how well you manage the risk from the buyer's standpoint. So we look at deals from a much more stable and predictable standpoint than taking 100 companies and trying to sell them for 10 times revenue.
Is it all about the numbers? I mean, obviously, your foundation is mathematics, and you're very heavily having taken your career into the financier side of valuation and so forth, and we are talking multiples here. Cash is king. Clearly, revenue doesn't matter a blip. If you're not converting that to cash, it doesn't really matter in terms of valuation for a business. But is it really all about the multiples? There are companies out there that the most part get relatively low multiples. Those are not the Googles of the world.
Right.
But then there's that exponential multiple that comes out of nowhere that people don't even understand how they generate income. Help us understand, you know, there are these nebulous companies. I mean, look at Facebook, look at Twitter, look at Google. I mean, heck, look at the World Wide Web. 15 years ago, it wasn't really there. So those ideas have spurned a phenomenal new opportunity for business. Help us understand when you look at a corporation and somebody comes to you and say, hey, I've got the best widget in the world or I've got the best service in the world. How do you evaluate that?
Well, I will tell you a little personal confession. First off, I don't own Google. I will not buy into that little fund that Goldman's put together for Facebook because I don't understand how they can be worth that much. And those are business models that I am absolutely confident that at some point will become more like MySpace. Right? So it's just a matter of timing. There's a really interesting article I read in The Economist within the last couple of weeks, which is about the momentum effect, where stocks, people who invest in stocks that overperformed in the last 12 months will typically overperform in the next 12 months by about 10% against the market return in general. And those who invest in stocks that underperformed in the last 12 months will underperform the market. So this is exactly the opposite of the value investing mantra that we all read about. In the long run, the value investing mantra is the one that prevails. In the short run, there's this momentum effect. So the market's irrational.
And is it more a case of at a point in time, i.e. the transaction, the sale, the purchase, that you are looking at what might be called a somewhat diluted version of future momentum? And momentum is very candidly, purchases of stock and those kind of assets, investments, they're very much more emotional for the most part.
I'm going to take you back to the, you know, bring it back to the ground again, though, because the way we look at our world, I am not working for 3 years to find that one deal that's going to make me $10 million as commission. Right? I'm looking at a way of helping people work through deals in a much more solid way so we close deals predictably on a regular basis in a much more solid and almost an industrial way. The multiples, these outrageous multiples, they do exist. And if you chase enough deals, you can find them. I spent a little bit of time, you mentioned the finance site period, I spent a couple of years in there working with a lot of startups. And my naive philosophy at the time was that the only competitive advantage you have in making investments is the people you know. So you hang around good people and they start cool businesses. You like the business model. You can get in on the ground floor with them and work with them and create value in the business. I, of course, in the back of my mind had some idea of the statistics around that, but it's only when I really got in there and did it that I realized how true it is. I think you've got to do about 50 of those before one of them has a chance of doing anything. And anybody who's involved in the angel world will know this. And you take that on by an order of magnitude when you're looking at companies like Facebook or Google. I'd also suggest we had a period right around 2000, and we saw a lot of this in the telecom world, where there were some, there were a lot of ridiculous multiples out there. And I think what we're seeing as people talk about is returning to what is described as a new normal. I actually think this is the old normal. You just got to go back 15 years till
before we find
common sense,
yeah.
Right?
And one could argue the same of the housing market.
Absolutely.
A lot of the rebalancing that's taking place that have financial implications for the economic times.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of those transactions. Let's start getting down to the nuts and bolts of things. What happens when a company comes to you and they say, Gareth, I'd like to put my company up for acquisition, and we're ready, we're nearing being ready. What are those initial conversations about?
The first one is about understanding the business and the market, and the second one is about understanding the people and their objectives. I moved from the large corporate world, as you observed, down to initially my own business and now the mid-market M&A world. And that's a totally different way of relating to business. You're relating to the an environment where the owners and the senior management really can't separate their personal lives from their business life. The two are kind of merged in an interesting way. So the solving problems approach, which I take to things, requires you to understand the business and understand the personal objectives. So what is the owner's nut? How much do they need to make before they can call it quits? Or are they selling this with a view to starting something else? I mean, you've got to understand those kind of things.
Typically, is it a retirement program for them?
A lot of the time, and this gets to what will be the next conversation typically, but a lot of the time what's happened is the owner found themselves relatively young in life with a particular passion, a particular expertise, and a particular skill, and they did something for somebody and it worked and they got paid for it. So they did it again and again. And that grew into a steady income stream, became so substantial that they hired a bunch of people around them. And then you end up with a complicated personal cash flow. And then at the age of 50, 55, they start recognizing that they're not immortal. And so they've got to do something to move on from that. And what they've done is they've created something that is not yet self-contained value. It's not yet a transferable asset. It's a complicated personal cash flow statement.
With employees and fixed costs and leases. And
absolutely. But the business, a lot of the intellectual property, even relatively large businesses, a lot of the intellectual property is in the owner's head. A lot of the key customer relationships are in the owner's head. A lot of the financial record keeping is ad hoc and based, the decision making is based on the owner's judgment. So there's a way to go from that to creating an asset that's transferable.
So typically speaking, when that business owner comes to you, they have had success through lack of formalization, through the narcissism or the ego or the direction of one, mm-hmm. or maybe a couple of partners. How do you translate that in their mind for what you're describing as an element of formality, an
right.
element of succession planning? Let's face it, selling your company is the ultimate succession plan.
That's right.
So how do you get them ready for that?
Ideally, I'll give you a for instance. I just had lunch with somebody who, she had a blowout year last year. Her business grew by something between 50 and 100%. It's a business that's got revenues of a little north of $2 million, something in that neighborhood. And she will probably end up selling that business in 3 to 5 years. But I had a conversation with her. I met her about a year ago, and she got it. She recognized that if she ever wants to grow her business and sell it, she can't just be doing it on an ad hoc basis. She's got to start thinking about things like when she brings a new employee on, they've got to sign an employment agreement, which has a non-compete and a non-solicit of employees in there. Right? You've got to start thinking about developing processes, developing a business structure so that the owner can elevate themselves above the fray and move to a place where they spend the majority of their time on strategic thinking, on business planning, rather than on day-to-day management down in the weeds.
So they're likely to be bringing on additional management yeah. as well as formalization of operations.
And as you know, anybody who's watches large corporations grow divisions recognizes that there are periods of evolution in that, and the person you put on a business to start it isn't the person you want to run it through growth, and that isn't the person you want to run it when the business is mature. So to take an owner through those, through that educational process where they recognize their own limitations and are willing to bring in other people and trust other people, and to help them figure out the kind of structures to put in place to get them comfortable doing that and to make sure that does work and that doesn't allow value to leak out the door, is challenging, but it's a lot of fun. And it really helps people.
And so therefore, part of what you're talking about is that you're helping a business owner look at the beginnings of an exit plan.
Correct.
When should a company look to that exit?
Today. The longer ahead you plan for it, the better that exit will be. Also, the longer ahead you plan for it, the better your business will be, the better run your business will be, the more time you will have in your life. Because if you think about a business owner who manages to climb out of day-to-day management to this more executive oversight role, that owner will be able to take off for their kids' basketball games, right? And that owner will be able to look at the business and think strategically about where to put the business, where to open new markets, and make strategic hiring decisions to make their life easier. They'll also be able to look at where the core value of the business is. If you, as part of your exit strategy, as you should be, are thinking about who the logical buyers are of your business, whether by name or by category, you'll start looking at what you are really doing as a business, start figuring out where you differentiate yourself, and you'll identify some outlying stuff that you're doing that you really shouldn't be doing. And if it's a necessary part of your overall package, you find somebody to outsource it to or somebody to partner with. So you focus on where you're really creating value. So you end up with a better business and a better lifestyle, as well as ending up with a better exit at the end of the day.
Do many of the transactions and the business owners that are in the category, and again, for the listener's perspective, I want to reiterate that the typical size of business that you're dealing with has revenues of that $5 to $30 million. While I know that there are some that are greater than that in terms of size, that perhaps is a good multiple.
Yep.
In terms of what your core focus is. When these companies come to you, is there a little bit of the light turns on and, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that? What are those aha moments?
It's very different for everybody. There's a company that I've just talked about one. There's a company that comes to mind as you ask the question where they are a niche provider in the kind of an energy-related business. And so they had been thinking, because the three or four other niche players in that space had been acquired by mainstream energy gas companies, actually. They had thought that there was one logical gas company who would acquire them. And I last had a conversation with them a little while ago about a dialogue that they were currently having with that company, and which, as best I can tell, happens every couple of years. Well, looking at that from the outside, it's pretty obvious where leverage lies on that. Having been in the corporate world and knowing that anybody who wants to, inside the corporate world, take forward to their CFO that I've got a great new line of business I want to get into and here's a company I can go acquire, CFO is going to, number one, say, well, where's my ROI on that? And number two, he's going to say, well, looks to me like you've already got them where you want them, so why do you need to buy them? So that radically changes the way those guys look at their business and the way they look at their exit strategy. So it's different for everybody. What's important is to take the time to understand somebody's business in order to be able to talk about it from that personal standpoint.
And are most of the acquisitions by the multinational corporations, is that typically the kind of transaction that you're dealing with?
It's all over the board, actually. We do, and it the best deals are the ones where you do find a larger scaled strategic buyer, whether that's a scaled domestic buyer or an international buyer. Because obviously those people see the greatest extent of value. They've got a product set. They can take over all of their customer base, and they can eliminate a large chunk of overhead. If there's not an obvious market for that, then we will look at whether there's a way to take it to the private equity world, because those guys, typically they've either got a platform business that they'd add this to, or there's an opportunity to make this their platform business.
And this can spur some growth for them.
So again, you've got the opportunity within their universe of leveraging it into growth and squeezing costs out so they see more value. So those are where we try and position businesses. To do so effectively typically requires a little more planning. So again, that requires getting to know the business and helping them to think about their exit strategy ahead of time.
And of course, that multiplier then extends the timeline.
That's right. And if you haven't done the planning and it's kind of an ad hoc thing where somebody's getting divorced or moving to California and they've got to do something very quickly, you're just dealing with what you've got. And it's much more likely to be individual to individual, which certainly is a worthwhile transaction, but it may not be an optimal transaction.
So let's maybe take that as a stepping stone and talk about the transaction or the exit plan.
Mm-hmm.
What typically is that?
What is it? You've got to, first off, you've got to create, you've got to turn your business into transferable value, which talks about capturing all the value of the business in the business, making sure it's documented, making sure that the people are tied to the business. So you've got employment agreements, you've got some kind of hooks into a couple of the key players, whether those are equity hooks or long-term compensation hooks. You've got all the intellectual property documented, you've got high-quality financial records, you've got budgets that you've created, that you've monitored yourself against, that you've done a reasonably good job of tracking against. You've got a self-contained business that's really operating as a business, and it's all out of the owner's head into the business. Secondly, you've got to have run your business with a view to positioning it for exit, which says, who are your logical buyers? You've got to be thinking about where you will sell this business. And we talked about that a little bit a minute ago, about figuring out where your core value is. And thirdly, it from a personal standpoint, from the owner or the owners, they have to be ready. So it has to be at the right time in their life. They have to have done the appropriate financial planning for their own retirement to make sure that the dollars work out, but also from a more complex standpoint on the planning side, they've got to have made sure that the assets are in the right place.
From a legal perspective,
we help people buy businesses, and one of the first things that a person buying a business should think about is their exit strategy, because that will state where they should buy the business. If their plan is to run it for 5 years, make a healthy income for 5 years, and then sell it and leave the proceeds for their kids, then they should be thinking about trust vehicles and, some advanced planning around how you own the business. So those kind of considerations should be dealt with by an owner ahead of exit as well.
So taking that one step further, what lessons have you learned about M&A transactions, whether on the buy side, sell side? We've talked a little bit about valuations. We've talked a little bit more depth about the exit and the exit strategy. What are there any particular lessons that you would suggest that the business owner looking to sell or buy would need to learn from the get-go?
There's an awful lot.
Okay.
I think I've spent 15, 20 years, whatever it is, doing deals, and that's what I do. So the technicalities, the ins and outs of making the deal mechanic work are something that if I'm not very good at that, there's something wrong here. So I kind of take that for granted. What I really bring to the table when I work with somebody, those skills are things that I use. It's around expectation management, process management, all the soft, touchy-feely stuff. Because thinking about doing a deal is a very different thing from getting a deal to the closing table, managing through a very complex emotional process to get a deal to a closing table. So actually that's something we at Abraxas think we do a particularly good job of, is managing that deal process, acting as the coach and the advisor and the buffer between the buyer and the seller. That's really where we focus our energy, is getting to the closing table. It's very important, I think, that an owner of a business surround themselves with the right advisors. And that gets to having the right CFO, having the right person in there managing the numbers, reporting, and giving them the information they need. Because when anybody's buying a business, that's the first thing they're going to look at. Of course, they're going to read the business plan and look at the market overviews and all the rest of it. But if the numbers don't hang together and aren't well supported, nothing counts. So having the right CFO in place is really, really important.
And would you recommend that in terms of these advisors in today's world, you could, just as you can bring in an attorney, you can today bring in a good CFO, mm-hmm, on an interim or project basis. Are those often tactics that are employed?
Absolutely. Those are very important tactics. The key advisors, I think, are the financial advisor, the CFO, the lawyer, and typically you're going to outsource to a law firm, and essentially you're outsourcing your general counsel function, at least for a substantial period of time. And a wealth manager, somebody who's going to deal with the family planning and the tax planning side of things. You may separately have a tax jock out there, somebody who's really playing the tax game, playing the code.
This is on a platform beyond if you're looking at international markets.
Absolutely. But those are the core players, and yes, absolutely, part-time. It's much better to have high-quality part-time folks than mediocre full-time folks.
And one could argue that you're getting independence of opinion.
Absolutely.
And advice.
Absolutely.
Well, taking the business owner's perspective, now he's or she is surrounded by advisors, good advisors. Do you actually see business owners achieving what they desired from the sale of their business, or is there some kind of a gotcha that's going to whip around and snap them from behind?
It comes back to what I do for a living, where I say I place the value, and that's process and expectation management. If I do my job right, I will come in, I'll spend a little bit of time with the owner. It really doesn't take a huge amount of time to figure this out and be able to fairly candidly but courteously talk through with them what they've got and what they can do to get it to where they want to be. But, you know, where they are today, understand where they want to be, and start talking about how to bridge that gap, which may take time. And if they don't want to take the time, we'll be very candid about where we are today and what we think that looks like today. And if they want to move ahead and sell the business, we can do that. But so the gotchas are around process and expectation. It's one of the other things that I think is very, very important when you're selling a business is to do an excellent job of creating an information memorandum about the business. Because you're going to go out, you're going to market the business, you're going to find potential buyers, they're going to come in, they're going to look at the business. On larger businesses, you'll do your management presentation day, and they'll all get excited. And then they'll come in, they'll look at a little bit of information, they get more excited, and then they'll come in and do due diligence, and there's oh, no, I didn't, all right? So you can't afford
revenue
those.
Recognition isn't per gap, and they're not using the accruals basis. And by the way, you can't have that classified there on the P&L.
And you've got potential litigation that nobody bothered telling them about, and they're actually using paper-based systems, and there's only two salespeople who have all the customer contacts, and neither of them have employment agreements. I mean, you can't afford to stumble into gotchas halfway through the deal process. So adequate preparation, making sure you know your business well enough up front.
Is that a case of doing due diligence internally before you go through that process?
In the good old corporate days, we used to call that reverse due diligence, and we do that on every business we sold, and we'd bring in our CFO firms and our accounting firms to do all that for us. In the smaller business world, it's going to be a much less formal process, but we will certainly, if we're representing a business, we will go in there and really understand the business and write a comprehensive information book so that our expectation is if somebody does come in to do due diligence, they will know everything that matters.
And so they've got the platform to start from.
It'll be an exercise truly in verification, not in discovery. And that's if you're going to sell a business, that really is the way you need to look at it.
Yeah. In advance, knowing what the acquirer is going to be looking for, and that's
right.
Where firms like you come into play because you've been there, done that on both sides,
that's
and
right.
Do that today.
And every business has something that you don't really like. You have to figure out what those are and then think about the proper way of positioning and the proper timing of communicating those in the process. So you just have to control that process.
Well, going back to our very original news report for this week's CFO radio show, Kiplinger quoted a very much more rosy horizon for 2010-2011 than in the previous couple of years. What do you see on the horizon? Did we reach that rosy position of 2010? We're now going into 2011-2012. What do you see?
He talked of three things. He talked of economics, the general economic situation. He talked about lending, and he talked about the gap between the buyer and the seller. I think he called it the chasm between the buyer and the seller. The general economic situation we do see improving. Businesses that I'm in touch with and working with generally showing materially improving financial results over the last 12 months. The lending situation, it continues to be confusing.
I mean, it's a tough market.
It's a tough market. I could editorialize on it, but it's a tough market. But part of the challenge businesses have had is they've been taking poor results to the bank. And if you start taking more robust results to the bank, I have to believe that's going to improve. And I think you've had people you've interviewed on this show over the last few weeks who've talked about banks getting back to where they pay, you know, back to the historical levels of dividends and so forth. And so I'm optimistic that that will be changing and will continue to improve over the next couple of years, maybe not next year, although it is getting better, you know, not back to where it was. And the third one, the chasm between the buyer and the seller, if you go back to the very basic point that businesses are bought as a multiple of historic cash flows, then as historic cash flows revert to where they used to be or get back, you know, cash flows start improving, the baseline starts improving. As general economic confidence improves, which we are seeing, and, you know, all that money parked is starting to move, we're seeing very clear signs that's happening, then the multiples will start to return a little bit. But very importantly, the other thing that has been happening is sellers were stuck on an inflated view of value based on the go-go days. And time is a wonderful healer. It's been a couple of years now, and people are getting a little jaded and starting to recognize, not just to intellectually recognize that that's not there anymore, but to emotionally move on from it and start to forget what that was about. So we're seeing all of that happen. So I'm seeing that chasm. There's still a gap. There always will be. And, you know, banks only finance 80-90% of a deal because people always have different views of values. And part of this game is helping people figure out how to close those gaps. But yes, we're seeing it get better.
Well, before we end today, I've got a couple more questions, but I can't move on without asking you about your book. We said earlier your first book was published a couple of years ago. Talk to us a little bit about the book and why you did it and what it's about and so forth. Give you a chance to have a little bit of a plug.
There we go. Go to Amazon and look up The Grace of Guilt and go buy it and write lots and lots of wonderful reviews.
It's not a finance book, I take it.
It's absolutely not a finance
book. Okay. So for the finance people out there, if you want to have a bit of light reading.
There you go. The little bit about it. About 10 years ago, this actually comes from meditating. About 10 or 15 years ago, I started meditating on a regular basis. And one of the things that happens when you start doing that is all the lots of layers of conditioning and accreted self start flaking away. And this underlying creativity that I'd never recognized started coming out. And mathematics, if you think about it, is actually, if you think of Einstein and Archimedes jumping out the bath and running down the street naked, mathematics is an incredibly creative field. But I'd always thought of it as logical and structured. So I started, I opened up that creative well, if you like. And one day I just had lots of ideas and I thought, well, I just ought to write these down. And by lunchtime I had 5,000 words. And so that was about a decade ago. I've actually written 4 novels and a couple of nonfiction books. And there's one of my other novels is one I hope to get out there this year, actually. This year now, yeah. So The Grace of Guilt, there are 3 little cameos that came together. And they are all things I picked up in different places. The first is a story I heard, secondhand story. It's a real story of a teenage girl in a radically fundamentalist rural Christian community who was raped by the preacher's son. The preacher's son was exonerated, and she was kicked out of church and family as a fornicator. I met the person who that story was about. And I've subsequently talked to several people who've got comparable stories. You know, and this happens in every fundamentalist religious tradition. This just happens to be Christian because of the way where we are in the world. But that's where it comes from. The second one is a teenage boy whose mother discovered he was homosexual. And her reaction was one of horror that he, by his volitional acts, had excluded himself from her eternal hereafter. So these are little things that dug in like...
So there's some deep-rooted value creation or values in terms of family and life values.
That's right.
So that's a long way from the CFO role.
That's a long way, yes.
So let me take you back. We have a tradition on the show, and this is our last question of the session. We've got a tradition on the show to ask your CFO tip of the month. What is yours?
Well, I won't presume to say that everybody has a novel inside them, but I will presume to say that everybody has some creative spark within them, whether that's painting or cookery or gardening or writing novels. Everybody has something like that. I think the CFO and the financial tools are to be brought to bear to solve problems, and problems are solved best by bringing creativity to bear. So I would encourage folks to engage the right side of the brain, find that which you enjoy creatively and engage in it. And actually, most of the successful people, probably all of the successful people I know, have some creative offshoot that they really enjoy and they engage in and they derive an awful lot out of. Not everybody's going to open up and talk about that straight off the bat, but I think it's there for most of the successful folks, you know.
Well, that's a great tip, and certainly us CFOs out there, we could do with a little bit of balancing in terms of the logical side of our brain. So thank you, Gareth. And thank you to Gareth Young, our guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. Thank you also to our contributor, Kiplinger, from the Kiplinger Letter Report. And thanks goes to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and fast-growing businesses alike. For more information about the company, go to www.delaneyllc.com. Thanks go to SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small to medium-sized companies. For more information, go to www.sap.com/SME. And to Financial Executive International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives, their website is www.financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show or know one, please contact us via the web. Thank you very much to listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.